mean anything. It doesn't necessarily impact on how you are going to present your own information. Like I've said to other candidates, we would like to apologize for having kept you for so long. And unfortunately, the nature of these processes are such that you have to do our job, and members must be given an opportunity to ask questions. And we are not barring members from asking any question. Without further ado, Mr. Wolf Mayor, you were told that you were going to be given 10 minutes to make your case before this panel. And as you know, this is broadcast live. And so when you are making your case, you're not only making it to the panel here, but you are also making it to the viewers at home. So it's over to you. Mr. Wolf Mayor. These members are still wide awake, and I have to keep on telling them not to disturb you. Go on, Mr. Wolf Mayor.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the committee for the honor of being nominated to appear here before you. It really is a great honor also to be with so many other eminent South Africans who've been nominated with me. The current Public Protector has certainly taken this office to a new level, and I think the challenge for us is, for whoever is successful, is to try and build on what she has achieved. I believe strongly, though, in general, that we can always do better than what has been done before. And in this document, I will try and set out some of my vision about what I think can be done by the Public Protector, both by working smarter and by building capacity. I'm obviously not going to be able to say everything I want to say in 10 minutes, so I hope you will ask me questions that will allow me to expand on some of it. I have a fairly good idea of how the Public Protector works, both because while I was a Member of Parliament, I worked on the constitutional provisions for the Public Protector as well as the Public Protector Act that came to the Justice Committee at the time. At both the Asset Forfeiture Unit and the SIU, I worked with the Public Protector on a number of cases. And frankly, I was also investigated, or my staff was investigated by the Public Protector when certain people that we'd acted against made complaints against the Asset Forfeiture Unit. I'm glad to say that nothing was found wrong in what we had done. I applied for this position because I believe I have the right skills and experience for the position. But also it's because it's a position I would be proud to fill. And where I believe I can make a real impact and difference to the scourge of maladministration and corruption in our country. My passion has been to make a difference to South Africa and to help to better the lives of ordinary people. And I've tried to do this both of my previous life as an activist and a human rights lawyer, but also in the work that I've done at the Asset Forfeiture Unit and the SIU. I do have good knowledge and experience of state institutions at all levels. I've got a good idea of what works, what doesn't work, and what can be fixed and how it can be fixed. Especially from my work at the SIU and its investigations and recommendations for remedial action, which is quite similar to what the Public Protector does sometimes, but also for the strategies that we helped to develop at the Anti-Corruption Task Team and from the cases, corruption cases done by the SIU. I believe that the Public Protector should be doing broadly four kinds of cases. I think the first one is the ones we're probably most familiar with, the very big individual cases that matter because they involve large amounts of money and the waste of public resources. And they also impact most on the perceptions that the public have about corruption in our country. Secondly, I think the other areas in our country where there are big systemic problems that affect many people, but they aren't big transactions. I'm talking about issues like bribery to get driving licenses, traffic fines that disappear, very often for RDP housing or for jobs, people are required to pay bribes. And then I think another area that I would like to sort of highlight is cases that impact on the future of our country. I think the sale of jobs in schools, for instance, is for me something that really has the potential to have a very negative impact on the future of our children and the country. I think there has been some debate about whether the public protector should play some role in government's anti-corruption strategy. And while I think it's important that it must remain independent, I do think there are areas where it could cooperate with a more general anti-corruption strategy, and that we should explore that. And finally, I also think it's important, there's a lot of concern about social justice issues in our country. I think it's important that some of the issues that are taken up impact on that, and in conjunction that we try and improve access to poor people to the services of the public protector. I have learned in my many years in the state, it's now 17 years, that we can do more by working together in partnerships with other institutions. As I said, I have worked with both the AFU and the SIU with the public protector, and I think one can build on some of those collaborations for the future. And I think it is difficult in the government. You know, we even battle to have a policeman and a prosecutor driving together in the same car because of insurance and accounting officer issues. So working together is not always easy. But I think the anti-corruption task team has shown what can be achieved by a really structured working together. And I think that I would like to explore. I myself have, I think, built up a good track record of developing strong partnerships with other law enforcement and other bodies. And really by doing it through well-structured and formal relationships that benefit both partners to achieve their goals, and by sharing the credits for the work that has been done, which is often a big issue. In terms of my skills and experience for this job, I have considerable experience and skills in managing large and difficult investigations. And I think that is a big part of the job for the public protector as well. Most of my experience has been as head of the Asset Forfeiture Unit, the SIU, and the Anti-Corruption Task Team. I have managed some of the biggest white-collar crime cases in this country. Mr. Phillips, you will have read about in the meantime. The Legionet collapse, the Fidentia collapse, Mr. David King, Shabir Sheikh, the Bosasa case, Gauteng Health, and a big tax crook called Hendrik Delport. In all of those cases, we have frozen and in many cases seized assets at the Asset Forfeiture Unit. I've dealt with also with the very extensive civil litigation that happens in these cases because the crooks seldom want to go on trial. They want to fight all sorts of preliminary battles in court. I do think that I have the integrity to deal properly with these big and difficult cases. I believe resilience is very important in dealing with such cases. You will have seen from my disclosure, I've had faced criminal charges that's been laid against me. I've had many nasty press reports and so on. And I think those are things that are part of the job when you take on the big and powerful. I also do have some diplomatic skills, and I think I'm fairly good at trying to minimize those sort of fallouts and attacks and trying to deal with cases in a way that does not cause unnecessary sensation. I do have some other challenges that I raised in my questionnaire. I don't have the time to deal with all of that in the presentation now. Another area where I have good skills is in the sort of smaller systemic corruption areas that I alluded to before. The bribes for housings, RDPs, driving licenses. Those sort of cases where it is impossible, because the corruption is so widespread, it's impossible to investigate every single case. And you really have to devise a clear strategy to deal effectively with a significant volume of cases, but also to ensure that you focus on those cases that can have a deterrent impact wider than just the actual cases that you investigate. But also very important in those cases is to identify and work with the departments concerned to address some of the systemic weaknesses that emerge. I believe, though, that a big part of what we have to do is to develop more sophisticated investigative techniques. And especially at the SIU, we've developed quite a lot of expertise in cybercrime, using the massive data that there is on our telephones, computers, and everywhere else to help us break cases. Another very interesting area that we've explored with Treasury and others is the analysis of what is called big data these days, looking at the various records that the state has, whether it's on the procurement system, the payment system, and essentially setting tests that try to identify transactions that are potentially suspicious. Rather than trawling through all the cases, this has proved to be a very, very useful way of focusing investigations and obtaining results. And I think the last area that I've...
Mr. Hofmeyr, you have 2 more minutes to go.
The last area is business process analysis. It's on the slide, so I'm not going to say too much about it. I also wanted to just mention briefly, I do think that we need to build up the skills and the professionalism of our investigators in the state. There are new professional organizations that have been formed. I think we need to ensure that our investigators start joining those associations, that we work with them to up our skills and capabilities. Just a quick slide on all the work done on civil litigation at the Asset Forfeiture Unit. We've been to the Constitutional Court 11 times. We've won 10 of those cases. The other figures are on the board. I think an important issue here is the management of state institutions. I think there's a whole range of regulations, rules, procedures of how you run organizations in the state. I do believe that I have pretty good experience and knowledge of managing state institutions. I've been an accounting officer for a special investigation unit. I've been part of all the audits at the NPA. And I think lastly, one of the points that I would like to make is that we neglect the training of our managers in the state. We assume that people, when they are promoted, will be good managers. And I think one of the things that I've really seen bear dividends is to have much more intensive and specialist management training for our managers to ensure that we do our jobs better. Lastly, just to say, I do believe in participative management. I really believe in appointing strong people around you who can challenge you, force you to think, make sure that you are correct, but also that it's important to try and build consensus in your organization on how to tackle problems. It is not up to the big leader to try and do everything by himself. I think my time's probably up, so I may have to miss the last couple of slides. Thank you very much.
You will have an opportunity as members ask you questions if there are certain aspects that you think are important that you would like to put forward. Members, last time I had started this side. Now I need to start from that side. Are there any questions, members? Honorable Kuranov, there is no uptake this side. Or Honorable Shivambu, Honorable Swart, Honorable Msimang, is your hand up or you are just chatting with your good neighbor? I'm not sure. I'm just going through that side. Oh, it's down. Okay. So it's going to be Honorable Kuranov, Honorable Shivambu, Honorable Swart, and we'll come this way, then Honorable Masondo, then Honorable Breitenbach, in that order. You will get to the next round, Honorable Bongo. Honorable Kuranov?
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Thank you for your presentation. If I look at the comments of Corruption Watch, you know, they really praise you with regard to your leadership in terms of the AFU. And they say, you know, they really mention fantastic, noteworthy statistics. But then they come back with a sting in the last paragraph to say media reports, you know, and being a lawyer myself, I don't know how can that be evidence. But media reports have alleged that Hofmeyr played a central role in dropping corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma, and then they carry on. You don't need to comment on it, but I give you the opportunity if you want to comment on that. And then lastly, because of your history and your political, you know, entrance into parliament and so on, people might argue that you will not be independent. Can I have your views on the importance of the Public Protector's Office independence?
Honorable Shivambu, we are going to take all the questions. If you can just jot down. Honorable Shivambu.
Thank you. Can I quickly get a quick response on one question? Is it some of the cases that we led there is the Sheikh case, is the Shabir Sheikh case? Yeah, that, I wanted to understand what informed the decision then to only charge Shabir Sheikh with corruption charges, when the person whom he was committing the corruption with is Mr. Jacob Zuma. Why didn't you charge both of them? What was the legal sense in charging only one individual and then that person gets convicted?
Order.
And then,
order, Chair.
Hold on, Honorable Bongo.
Order,
continue.
Chair. No. This question is not relevant, and this question is sub judice. It would just constitute an extremely unfair question for the candidate to answer because the matter
you
is sub judice.
You know, members, you know one thing that I've observed with all of you. You are very inconsistent. We agree on a process, we allow all the different questions to be asked. Then at some stage when we get very sensitive, we want to stop the question. And it makes it very difficult for the chair. That is why I have swung from being a very good chair to Honorable Chief Bambi to being a very bad chair.
But I'm raising a matter of law, Chair. I'm not raising
saying,
a general matter.
I am saying to you, Honorable Bongo, I hear you, but I want Honorable Chief Bambi to ask his question. Because the challenge that you are going to have is that what if this question has got to do with his own exercise of fairness in his application of the law? I am not sure. But I'm just saying, let's just be tolerant, members. Please. You've been doing very well. Let's not spoil this thing. We only have how many candidates to go? We only have... two more to go. Okay, Honorable Shivambu, can you proceed?
Thank you, Chair, for protection from... yes, I was still continuing with that question. What was the legal sense of charging only Shabir Sheikh succeed and then he did not charge Mr. Jacob Zuma, the president of the ANC? And understand that in the process of dropping the charges, in the process of dropping the charges again now, the more than 700 charges of corruption, racketeering, money laundering, fraud. You were part of the decision that said that the charges must not be continued. What informed that? And now you have lost in court. The NPA has lost that decision in court. The charges have to be reinstated after it fails again in the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. What informed that? How should we trust you? Can't we now suspect you that maybe you are just some extension of the person whom you have been avoiding to charge for a very long time? Aren't you trying to come to the public protector's office to continue with the protection of a possibly corrupt individual who steals public money for himself to enrich himself and his own family, and is currently captured by a family that is corrupting the whole of South Africa? How should we trust you to be a public protector in South Africa when you've got a history of protecting one individual? Now, coming to practical issues on how are we going to handle with the issue.
Honorable Shavambu, if you can also remember that we still have other members to ask questions, please.
Thanks, yeah. How are you going to deal with the accessibility of the public protector's office, particularly in the rural areas? There's 54, 52 districts in South Africa. There's 20 offices of the public protector. There's 240 plus municipalities. It means that in many areas, far-flung areas of South Africa, you do not have public protector's offices. Practically, what are you going to do? The public protector incumbent already was discussing the issues of the funding model of the public protector's office on the basis that the appropriation process does not allocate adequate money to the office of the public protector to reach out to everyone, to deal with all the cases that are brought forth for the attention of the public protector. So what are you going to do if you ever become a public protector, which is not a recommendable thing to do, Sean?
Thank you very much. And as a matter of record, this is the former spokesperson of the African National Congress Youth League. Proceed, Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, what is the relevance?
Honorable,
why don't you say that former spokesperson of a former organization that doesn't exist anymore? So at least that was going to be relevant.
Honorable Shibambu, that's history, we can't change it. He said he was arrested in 1976. That's history, we can't do anything about it. It's history. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's good to see Advocate Hofmeyr again. We've come a long way together, and you've been exceptional in the SIU, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, the NPA. What makes you want to leave the NPA when you've been doing such an incredible, good job there, and the need over many, many years that I've seen the work that you've done there to apply for the public protector? I think you may be eminently suitable for it, but in weighing up how best your abilities are applied, and is it carefully phrased this? You did very well in the SIU, and then you were moved. You did very well in the Asset Forfeiture Unit, and then you were moved. Now you are in charge of legal civil claims in the NPA. Do you have a sense of frustration in the NPA? And is that why you're seeking greener pastures? You don't have to. Can I just also then, on page 17 of your page, there's a whole lot of issues there that really show you're standing up against your own political comrades when it comes to certain issues, such as when Advocate Piccoli was suspended. You referred to the Celebi matter. I just wanted to ask you particularly, you referred to standing up against the then NDPP, Mr. Simelane, about his decision to withdraw the freezing order relating to 100 million rands worth of assets of Mr. Fani Shlongwani, and that was the arms deal issue. On that particular issue, what is your response to the Commission of Inquiry now that has found there was no corruption, given that stance that you took in those years about that freezing order? Then can I just ask you, with your vast experience and having been a member of Parliament here as well, the relationship between the public protector and Parliament, and particularly relating to the independence of the public protector as distinct from the NPA's side, the accountability to Parliament, how do you see that? And what was your view on the binding nature of the remedial actions before the Constitutional Court decision. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swarty. I almost said Comrade Swart. There's something comradely about you. I don't know what is it, but
I'm known as the Swart Gevaar.
Okay. Honorable Masondo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There's an issue I've long wanted to ask and get clarification on. Maybe today is an opportunity since Willie is here. And this issue relates to the way in which controversial issues are forever in the media with regard to NPA and related institutions. Hardly a week passes without this happening. So one will say, will note that William Hof Meyer said an experience in dealing with the media, maybe the UDF, the ANC, and so on. But there's this persistent, stubborn problem that refuses to disappear from the front pages of newspapers, or at least on page 2 and 3, or in the center spread of newspapers, center pages of newspapers. I thought it would be very important to raise this matter because it does a lot of damage in communities out there. Where the infighting in the NPA or related institutions is forever there in the public eye, and the issues don't seem to be resolved. Just a clarification of that.
Okay, Honorable Masondo. I think this question relates to what Honorable Shirvambo asked earlier on to the other candidate about this thing of ensuring the institutional integrity and managing the reputational risk of the institution. That's his question. It's not my question. I'm just paraphrasing it. Honorable Breitenbach?
Hi, buddy. How are you doing? It's preaching to the choir, believe me. You now hold the position of head of legal affairs in the National Prosecuting Authority, I see. I really don't know what that is.
Can it become audible?
Audible? Nobody ever complains they can't hear me.
No, but now, something that I don't know, somehow, I can hear you now.
Let's just knock the hair out of your ears. You're now the head of legal affairs. I really don't know what that is. So if you could just briefly explain, please, what the head of legal affairs at the NPA does. And then if, as the head of the legal affairs at the NPA, whether you had any role in advising the current national director to appeal the SPARTAF's judgment. What was your advice in that regard, if you were called upon to give advice in that regard? And then, in the SPARTAF's matter, initially, you deposed an affidavit that supported the dropping of charges against Mr. Zuma. That has been set aside by a court, but it's relatively common knowledge that you were one of the very few, if not the only person in the NPA who actually supported that decision. And certainly it flew in the face of the prosecution team, an experienced prosecution team. If you could explain why you took that stance. Thank you.
Honorable Bongo.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good evening. Mr. Hof Meyer, I think to start with, I must say this, that from the CV and from what I know about you is that you are a man of integrity. So that I can raise my hand for. And I do really appreciate that. You have contributed immensely in towards building the democracy that you are in. Now, I want you to share your views and ideas around the fit and properness of your candidacy around the issue that it is alleged. I want your comment that when we approached about the post, you said, you know, you're not going to be shortlisted. And that was taking rounds in the media circles. And when you were shortlisted, you also allegedly said that, I know I'm not going to be taken. So I want you to just comment around that, because it borders also around your fit and properness and your respect for this process that we're in. I think if you can just clarify those issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Bongo. I think the last question from Honorable Bongo, I actually share that. It was quite concerning, because throughout the process, we get into this process, you speculate and you cast aspersion on the process. When we get to the next process, again, you then say something else. Well, that's what we're seeing in the media. And maybe it's going to be important for yourself to place the correct perspective on record. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. That's a long list of difficult questions, but I must say I expected some of them at least. No, and they shouldn't be. Chair, I think to start with the questions raised by Mr. Korenhoff, I think the main point that I did want, you know, and I'll come back to the DA Zuma matter later. I filed a lengthy affidavit there that set out my position on a number of things. But just about the question that he raised about politics, I had devoted my life to politics, to the liberation movement in our country. But when I was appointed or asked to act in the position in the NPA, I realized very quickly that it was a potentially conflict of interest kind of position. Because very soon cases came to the NPA where ANC comrades that I knew very well were being accused of crimes. Sometimes there were accusations that they were being accused falsely. But I realized that it would be very difficult for me to remain a member of the ANC and take decisions about people that I knew very well with credibility. So I let my membership of the ANC lapse. I did not renew it after my appointment. I think I still broadly support the ideas and policies of the ANC, but I've not attended a single ANC meeting, I think maybe since 2001 or even earlier than that. I've remained neutral in party political terms. And I think that is important for my work, because for the work that I was doing, because it is very easy to cast aspersions or to cast certain decisions as having a political agenda. And it's just awkward, you know. At that stage, I probably knew half the cabinet ministers, and if I seen in their company and the next day there's an accusation that has to be investigated, people will ask the question, how do you investigate somebody that you are seen with socially? So, you know, those were just tough decisions I faced early on, and I talked to some of my friends, and that was my decision, that I should adopt a politically neutral stance in my life, hard though it was. On Mr. Shivambu's questions, I think there were two cases. I cannot speak to you much about the decision taken by the then NDPP that there was not sufficient evidence to be sure of a prosecution. Although the entire NPA management was involved in that decision, I was excluded from that decision, so I only heard about it afterwards. We worked on the Sheikh case for several years, did a hell of a lot of work on it. I think the forfeiture order that we eventually got was for 43 million rand, which was quite one of the biggest orders we've ever obtained. I think there were a lot of questions at the time. I shared some of the reservations about whether that was the correct decision or not. But as I say, I was not given an opportunity to give my input into that decision. In relation to the dropping of the charges against Mr. Zuma, let me first say I'm not coming to the public protector to protect anybody other than the public. The decision that we faced with in 2009, I've dealt with extensively as other members have said in the affidavit I filed in the DA Zuma matter, and I would urge you to read it. It is a rather lengthy and painful story. But ultimately, the situation was that credible evidence, not just credible evidence, irrefutable evidence came to our attention that the previous head of the Scorpions and the previous national director were playing an extremely partisan role in trying to influence the politics in the ANC and who would be the next president of the country. I think I and many of my colleagues were very, very concerned about that because our real only action or option that we faced was that an application for a permanent stay of prosecution would be brought, and we would have to go to court and say, actually, it's not so bad that the NPA played politics in a case. It's not so bad that the court should stop it. I think we had quite a lot of debate about whether we should leave it in the hands of the court or whether we should take the responsibility. It was obviously Mr. Mshe ultimately who took that responsibility, but whether the NPA should take a responsibility for the decision. I think we all knew that the decision would be litigated eventually and the courts will have the final say. It's not that we thought we would have a final say on the matter. And I think it's right that the court should have the final say on the matter. All I can say is we were faced with a very difficult position, and I suppose history will judge us one way or the other whether that was the right decision or not. But it is a decision, certainly from my part, that I thought was important to try and retrieve the integrity of the NPA, which, if you think back about that time, was not in very good shape. In terms of your question about access to the public protector, I don't want to speak too much from outside, but I think there are interesting ways with modern media and the widespread access to modern media, social media and so on, that one can try and use to promote access and to allow easier ways of bringing things to the attention of the public protector. But it is, for me, linked a little bit to the questions that I didn't get to in my presentation, and that is that we have to accept that we have limited resources. I think one of the things I have done well in the organizations where I have been is to improve productivity dramatically. I'll show you the one slide, which is the performance of the asset forfeiture unit over the years that I was in charge of it. Despite a dip here and there, when our funding was radically cut after the 2009 crisis, I think generally we've managed to, by a combination of improved skills of our staff, better management, taking management training of our managers seriously, looking at our business processes and how we can make them more effective, we've managed to drive productivity up, both at the asset forfeiture and at the SIU over those years. And I think ultimately that's what we have to try and do at the public protector. We have to try and get more out of the resources that we have. I think given our fund, I think there are interesting ideas about other funding models for the public protector. But the reality is that we... I didn't hear it. There was too much noise in my ears. But the reality is all of us in this state have to up our game. We have to do more with less. And I think that is a challenge that I think I am reasonably well equipped, or maybe even pretty well equipped, to deal with. And so I think that is broadly my answer on that issue. I've looked at the strategic plan of the public protector, where there is a number of projects, again on the slide in front of you. I think all of these projects, whether it's the electronic case management system, standard operating procedures, capturing the best practices and getting them into your SOPs, developing customized training programs, these are all things that I have been doing for 5 to 10 years in both the asset forfeiture unit and the SIU. I have quite a lot of experience in using business methods to try and improve our productivity and outputs, and I think it's borne success. It's not an easy or quick fix process, but I think that is one of the ways in which we can do it. I think the other things that I've alluded to is better work with other organizations that operate in the same or similar terrains, and seeing what we can do, how we can divide up work where it is appropriate. And that's particularly in your big cases, which are incredibly resource intensive. I do, on another slide also, I have consistently over many years managed to persuade Treasury to put more money into both the asset forfeiture unit and the special investigating unit. And I think I have quite a lot of credibility with Treasury in terms of being able to deliver improved performance commensurate with the extra funding. So I'm not saying this is going to be easy in the current environment, but, you know, it has been done in the past. And I think the other issues that I've raised earlier about better training, professionalizing, using smarter technologies for investigations are all things that we can do to improve our productivity with the resources that we have. I think the reality is, though, the more the public protector delivers, the more the public is going to want it to deliver, so I don't think we're ever going to be in an easy situation where we can say we're satisfying all the demand for the services. But I do think that it's possible to do considerably better with the existing resources if we have a serious look at how we do business. And I must say, I don't like to be arrogant. I know I'm talking from outside. I don't know the details, but I was impressed that some of these issues are on the agenda at the public protector already. But, you know, those are the sort of things I think that one can use to address the long-term issues. I think there has been some ideas about the funding model for the public protector, whether other sources of money can perhaps be channel to the public protector. I think those are issues that Parliament more than us has to grapple about and whether it's possible. But certainly, I think the success of the public protector in many ways has generated an increased demand for the services, and I think we have to find ways of coping with that. But that it's more a policy issue to some degree. There's some things we can fix internally, but the other things, it's up to the legislature and government. I was asked why I would like to leave the NPA. I'm not doing the job in the NPA anymore that I was recruited for and where I had expertise, that is asset forfeiture. The job that I'm doing at the moment is mainly to be an efficient post box to channel civil claims to the state attorney. Can't say it's a job that makes me jump out of bed every morning. And it's also not a job that keeps me busy for more than 3 hours a day. And I like to work 10 to 14 hours a day, so I'm a bit frustrated. And that's why I am interested in other positions. I didn't apply for this, to get back to your suggestion, I didn't apply for this position in the expectation that I will get it. I knew that there are some really good candidates, some of them who have been in the public protector, have the experience of the work. But I thought I had a reasonable chance to get the job, and that's all that I've said. I don't know what you have heard, but I was hoping to be shortlisted, and I do have a reasonable expectation that I may get the job. But I will never assume that the job is there for the taking for me. It is a process, and the process should go its proper course. I think from Mr. Masondo, the question of controversial issues in the media, I have deep concerns about what's happened in the NPA. I had deep concerns about what happened to me. I kept them to myself until the NDPP filed an affidavit in a court case that accused me of having no integrity and manipulating processes and so on. I agonized about that very deeply. I consulted with senior counsel and other lawyers that I respect very deeply, and they advised me that I should file an affidavit to put the record straight. It was not an easy thing to do. It was pretty painful to do that to my own organization or to the boss in my organization. But I think it was, however painful it was the right thing to do. And my integrity matters to me. If people are going to accuse me of misbehaving, of lying, I do have to answer it. And that was the only legal way in which I was able to answer it. Fortunately, those are difficult things to do, but sometimes to do the right thing is difficult. I've done it in the past. I've not shirked away from the consequences, and if I have to do the right thing, I'll do the right thing. I'm trying to see if there are any of the questions. Arms deal. Sorry, you'll have to remind me. But I think the other issue that was raised was the affidavit I filed in the DA matter. I think I've answered to some degree the question. For the rest, I do think that there has been over time in our country, unfortunately, attempts to manipulate law enforcement to help certain people and to protect and to harm others for political reasons. And I think, that's something I have fought against in all my time at the NPA. In the beginning, I may have been a little bit naive about some of the things that were going on. But I do think that one has to find a way of sending a very strong message about that. If we say it's not so serious, that has very, very deep consequences. And I can't say that I sleep easily about that. It was a tough decision. I consulted a number of people that I really trusted about my own views there. And I still think that it, even though it's heavily criticized, that it was the right decision in the circumstances to make. But I can see why other people who perhaps have not suffered the same pain that I have disagree with me.
Honorable members. Honorable Swartu, you appear to have a follow-up question.
Help Advocate Hofmeyr about the question about the seizure of the 100 million rand of assets of Mr. Shlongwane, where you opposed the then NDPP about his decision to withdraw the freezing order, and what, in the light of your decision there, what your view is of the Arms Commission that has just come out. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Breitenbracht, you want to have a follow-up too on that?
No, I don't want to have a follow-up. I want to have an answer.
Oh, just hold on there. Then Honorable Shimbabwe, you wanted to have a follow-up?
Yes, there's an important issue, Chair, which I think maybe you must speak to that relates to SIU and Public Protector. Can I speak to that briefly? That
you may?
Yeah, like what do you envisage to be the relationship in terms of investigation between SIU and Public Protector? I'll give you a specific example that in the Nkandla corruption, you conducted a parallel investigation and then came to a conclusion that the excessive payments and non-security upgrades and overpayment of fees amounted to about 155 million rands. With regards to Nkandla, and then the constitutional court processes concluded at 7.8 now, well, the percentage of what was supposed to be paid. What could be a consolidated investigative action so that we are not very far from each other in terms of some of the numbers that get to come to that? I know that when Parliament went to recess for the local government election now, they were request for Parliament to follow up on the decision of the Constitutional Court that because the President failed to uphold, defend, and respect the Constitution as the supreme law of the land, there must be some sense of action taken. So as part of the people who drafted the Constitution, it did not give that option of what happens to a president that breaks the law, and it's not necessarily a criminal case, but it's an issue that is about violating the Constitution. There is no such provision. What do you think is to be done now that there is a constitutional court ruling that says that a president has violated the Constitution? What should Parliament do? Can you please advise? I'm asking you, you'll provide a good assistance because you are part of those who drafted Chapter 9 of the Constitution. I'm sure you'll provide guidance.
Honorable Floyd Shivambu, I think we are going, if you can note that question so that you can answer it in the next round. I was under the impression that it was a follow-up question, and it's actually an entirely new question. Can you respond to Honorable Swart's question, follow-up question, so that I can go, so that I can take the other members quickly?
Thank you, Chair and Mr. Swart. Please, I'm not an advocate. I'm a proud attorney, so I'm just a mister. I think to recap what happened in the arms, in the Fana Hlongwane case particularly, is that the asset forfeiture unit had obtained, through mutual legal assistance requests and in conjunction with the Scorpions at the time, a lot of the investigation outcomes of the British and other international investigations. I think we had overwhelming evidence that certain sums of money in bank accounts, and I don't want to give rand figures at this stage because currencies and all of that, but significant amounts of money in overseas bank accounts were the proceeds of bribes, essentially. We took that evidence to court. The court granted us a freezing order. Subsequently, Mr. Longwana's lawyers made representations to the then national director. I sat in the representations. I was not persuaded that they had given any satisfactory explanation, but the national director was persuaded, and he decided that the application should be withdrawn. It is within his rights to withdraw it because it is brought in his name. So I think that he agreed that I could say publicly that we at the AFU disagreed with his decision. So it wasn't an act of rebellion. It was something that was agreed between us.
Suggest that you answer Mr. Honorable Shivambu's question after this round, which is the final round. Can I get the indication from members who would like to speak? Okay. Honorable Van Damme, Honorable Breitenbach. Oh, he hasn't answered your questions. Oh, okay. Honorable Breitenbach, if you don't mind, I just want to make sure that you answer the question. What aspect of your question was not answered?
All of it.
Okay.
So let me remind him.
Maybe you might have to help me.
I'll remind him. I asked what the head of legal affairs does. I have no idea. And then... Well, not sufficiently. And in that capacity, did you advise the national director in the appeal procedure now in the matter that's on appeal? And if so, what was your advice? And then it's commonly known that you were one of probably the only person who supported the dropping of charges against Mr. Zuma. Why did you do so? And why was the view of the prosecution team not given more weight at the time? Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to answer that question now? I haven't forgotten your question, Honorable Shivambu. He is going to answer it. This one is directly linked to what she asked earlier on, and what you raised later on was new from what you had raised. Yes, Mr. Hoffman?
Okay, let me say that the Legal Affairs Division is essentially supposed to deal with all civil litigation. After my appointment, it's supposed to was dealing with mutual legal assistance requests where we obtain evidence from other countries or vice versa, with our obligations under international treaties. Both those functions were removed from me once I had taken the position. It also deals with civil claims and applications that are brought against the NPA. Almost all those applications were also removed from the Legal Affairs Division and some of the claims. So that's why I don't have that much work left at the moment. On the issue of the withdrawal of charges, I think I've tried to answer as much as I can. But to say that initially I probably was the only person who felt strongly about the issue. In the end, the decision was taken by consensus by the top management of the NPA. So it was not me alone who took the decision. It was obviously the national director entitled to do it, but he'd consulted all his deputies. They all agreed, as did the then acting head of the DSO. So I'm not sure that I can add more to it. I know that you are upset about that decision, and we'll probably have to agree to disagree on that.
Yeah, I think, members, let's be fair as well. Sometimes there will be answers that are not necessarily what we expect, and that does not necessarily mean that we are not going to be satisfied with all answers from all candidates. So I'm saying if you can also remember that aspect. Okay. Honorable Van Dam, no. Your question is there, and I said you've noted Honorable Shivambu's question. I just want to take the round, the last round, for Mr. Hofmeyr. Can I have the hands again? Honorable Van Dam, you're going to come now. Honorable Horn, Honorable Pongo, no. Tseke, you want to come in? No. Okay. Honorable Motapo, are those the only people that want to speak? Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, Honorable Van Dam.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, Mr. Hofmeyr. Nice to meet you. I just have questions about Andrew Phillips. Are you familiar with that name? Mr. Phillips' lawyers submitted a letter to the committee objecting to your nomination, saying that you're not a fit and proper person. He states that in the year 2000, you oversaw a commando-style raid on his two businesses, the Ranch and the Twister, two strip clubs, I believe. All right. He alleges that you did so with ulterior motives. The matter went to court, and he was acquitted. And the judge found that you had singled him out for his assets and not his alleged crimes. What was the outcome of that matter? How much did that matter cost the AFU? And did you have to hand over Mr. Phillips' assets? And also, do you think you conducted yourself during that debacle with integrity?
Honorable Ohan? He's not sleeping. I can see. I'm the one who is chairing. I'm the one that is talking. Yes, Honorable Ohan.
Why are you picking me?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Mr. Hofmeyr, we're still on the spy tapes saga and the appeal. And yes, just to remind you that you still have not answered the question as to whether you advised on the decision to appeal.
I didn't have any role to play in the appeal of the matter.
And are you aware whether the original prosecuting team of Advocate Downer were consulted?
Oh, Honorable Motapo is the last speaker. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, yes.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Hofmeyr. How are you? Fine. Mr. Hofmeyr, it appears from your CV that your interpersonal skills with your senior NPA colleagues are a bit questionable. So will you kindly tell this committee your intention? Should this committee consider you for this position of a public protector? What do you intend doing in improving your interpersonal skills at Office of Public Protector? Secondly, you have a history of flouting procurement rules. And you know very well that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. In 2010 at NPA, National Prosecuting Authority, you flouted procurement rules and you were given a verbal warning because you authorized an amount of plus minus 20,000, which you know, it was contrary to procurement rules. Your comment on that. Again, at SIU, while you were acting head, again, you acted contrary to procurement rules. But in here, you made mention of union members, blah, blah, lot of things. Do you mind to highlight that? Why? Flouting of procurement rules. Generally, thank you so much for your dedication, for your commitment, for your integrity generally. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hofmeyr, if you could kindly answer the question starting from Honorable Shivambu's question up to the last speaker, Honorable Motapo. And I think it's also a good time for you to just make sure that you wind up properly at the end, because it's going to be this is your last time to speak. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. To get back to Mr. Shivambu's questions, I think, let me just say that at the time when the SIU investigated the Nkandla matter, I was no longer at the SIU, so I don't have the details. But my broad understanding is that there are different things that went wrong at Nkandla. So I think the Constitutional Court's ruling relates to undue enrichment, if one may call that in loose terms, by the president. And that's the money that the court, I think, has asked to be paid back. But I think a large amount of the money that was spent there was, if I might use the word loosely, was looted by service providers. And I think the SIU report relates to the amount of misspending, misappropriation, overcharging by service providers. And my understanding is that the SIU is trying to recover that money. I'm not saying that it's not possible that when different organizations collaborate, they may come to different conclusions. It is possible, but I don't think that was the case in this investigation. And I think what is important is that both those investigations essentially did end up covering a lot of the same ground, and that's why I'm saying there is some ground for cooperating in those sorts of cases. It's not always an easy solution, but I do think in a resource-scarce environment, we really have to see how we can use our resources optimally. Is that an answer to your question? To deal with Ms. Van Damme's question about Mr. Phillips, I have prepared a detailed written response that I will give to the committee. But to say in brief that all those allegations are ones that have been ventilated in court, they've been litigated to the Supreme Court of Appeal, to the Constitutional Court. All the allegations against me have been found to be groundless. To the extent that the Supreme Court of Appeal just narrowed, said that it was tempted to award a punitive cost order against Mr. Phillips, but it decided to stay with the normal cost order. So I've got the details in a written submission. If there are any further information the committee would like from me, I would be happy to give it. In terms of the money spent by the AFU on the case, I'm not there anymore, so it's a little bit difficult for me to get the information. But I think in total, the amount spent is probably in the vicinity of 80 or 90 million rand. And I have no problems with that amount. I know your eyebrows are rising. But we took on Mr. David King, for instance, between us, SARS, and the Reserve Bank. Mr. David King, I think, owed the states over a billion rand in fraud. In that case, between us, I think the state spent probably in the vicinity of 500 million rand. The reality is, if we want to take on big criminals who are very rich, we have to be able to fight fire with fire. We're going to say it's too expensive. We can't do this at a profit. It's actually going to cost us money to put somebody in jail or to seize their assets. We might as well give up the fight against crime. I think it's a benefit of AFU that it generally operates at a considerable profit. But if we say we're not going to take on cases because they're not guaranteed to make a profit, I think that's just plain wrong. Our job at AFU was not to make the state rich, it was to make criminals poor. And I think that we have to do if we are going to be effective against serious crime, whether it's economic crime, brothels, drugs, whatever. If we're not prepared to invest the money that is required, we won't deal with those cases. And sometimes we will lose. Those are high-risk cases. And when we lose, it costs the state money. So, you know, it broke my heart that a delay in obtaining the court record meant that it cost the state 80 million rand. But that is the brutal reality of what happened. I think Ms. Breitenbach had a further question about, was the prosecution team consulted? As far as I'm aware, they were not consulted, but that was only while I was still involved in the matter. But I don't know. Then on the last question, I think when I said in my CV that my management assessments had found me that I'm the kind of person who drives people quite hard. I'm a sort of thinking kind of strategic person. I'm a good leader, but I'm not so good at talking to people about their babies and how their families are and so on. So my soft people skills are not as good as they should be. I acknowledge that. I have tried to work on it because I think a leader does need to be interested in their staff members' well-being, but sometimes it's not always possible. Have I left anything out? I think that.
Chair, there was a question which, like the second part of my question about the Constitutional Court having found the president to have violated the Constitution. What happens?
You may respond, Mr. Hofmeyr, but as I said earlier on, some of the questions we are asking, our members may be expecting particular answers. And I don't think it is fair if you think you have answered that question. If the member is dissatisfied, it's still okay. I am not speaking on your behalf. But I am just saying that is also something that can happen. And I have observed this. Is there anything that you would like to say differently from what you've said, Mr. Hofmeyr?
Chair, I don't think that would fall within the domain of the public protector, but in the domain of Parliament. So I'm just being blunt here. I think I did omit one question about my history of flouting procurement rules. I don't think it would be fair to put it in that way. I was accounting officer for the SIU for 12 years, I think. In those times, there were no findings made about procurement irregularities. The charges that were laid against me were criminal charges laid by members of the union who were discontented at that stage. They were investigated. No charge was ever pursued against me by the police. The SIU itself had commissioned our auditors to do an investigation. They also were satisfied that there were no problems in the procurement. So the issue about the conference, it was a conference that my staff had attended every year of sort of forensic investigators. It was the only one at the time. There wasn't really alternatives. And unfortunately, it was just when the new procurement rules came in. I think the fact that I only got a written warning, I think it was demonstrated that it was not regarded in a particular serious light, and I've never had any subsequent issues like that.
Mr. Hofmeyr, I wanted to release you, but you know, the committee, they banned rules. We had agreed that we're going to make sure that, you know, up to an hour, but we have broken this rule, and I can't now say it can't be broken because it's you. I see Honorable Swart. He wants to say something.
It's not a question, but I just wanted to make a comment. And I know you're going to thank
All right, no problem.
Mr. Hofmeyr and wish him well with his application. But we've now got information as to his present utilization that is deeply disturbing to me. And it is, in fact, scandalous. And we need to take that information up in the appropriate portfolio committee. We wish him well with his application for this position, but he's been totally underutilized. And I'm sure that you, who are fully aware of the fiscal constraints, here you've got a very experienced person that is working 3 hours a day. And that, to me, is scandalous. And it needs to be taken up with the appropriate portfolio committee at a certain stage, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that was a comment. Are you okay now? Do you want to say something before you go? Or must I release you, sir?
Yeah, maybe if I can just highlight one or two issues on the slide. So it won't take more than a minute. But I think what I did try to say, perhaps in too many words there, that if one really looks at the way that organizations are put together and the different things that make them work, by doing interventions at a number of training levels, structural levels, and so on, I think we can produce significantly more with the same resources. And I think that is an area where I have demonstrated in the past the ability to really increase productivity and motivate, get staff to do that. So I just wanted to reiterate that point briefly.
Thank you very much, sir. Good luck, and we are going to be in touch with you.
Thank you very much.
Members, we are now going, we are only left with two. We have Lukaiman and Prof. Machola. You know, members, just on a, there is a point that Honorable Swart raised, which I think, you know, at some point, we must have an opportunity, just as members, and probably put aside our political differences, and really start addressing some of the weaknesses that we are seeing, that we are observing, and probably find a way of, you know, addressing these together. Because I can sense, despite our ruptures from time to time, I see a lot of goodwill, though, you know, and I think people, members are really sincere, and they are really committed to building this country. And I just wanted to say that, because you raised that issue, which was also another issue that was bothering me a bit, that we can't have somebody with such investigative skills and who has such extensive experience being so underutilized when our capacity in that area is very weak.